Welcome back, everybody, to Constructive Uncoupling, the podcast devoted to amicable divorces. I'm Judy Weigel, your host and amicable divorce expert. Why? Because that's all I do, amicable divorces. Today, we're featuring attorney Warren Scheel. Warren, I have found to be so knowledgeable about every aspect of family law. So this is the start of a series of interviews with Warren. And then the other three we have coming up will be with other professionals in the family law area. And we will shine a light on topics that will help all of you exponentially. Warren is in private practice in Los Angeles, and we're interviewing him from his office. Welcome, Warren.
Thank you for having me, Judith.
So would you like to add anything to what I already said in introduction before I start asking you questions on our topic, prenuptial and postnuptial agreements?
Yes. So good afternoon. I'm a certified family law specialist. You could probably tell by the accent that I'm English, originally from England. So I've practiced for 30 years, family law and divorce law. I started in the UK in the 1980s. I've also practiced in New York. And now I've been practicing in California for the last 16 years. I have my own practice in Century City. So again, thanks for having me.
Oh, this is delightful. Thank you for giving us your time. So let's just start. Our topic is prenuptial and postnuptial agreements. A lot of people think this is as simple as sitting down, writing something up, going to a notary, and then everything will be fine. But I know from talking with you, Warren, that that is absolutely not the case. Let's start with, please define what a prenuptial agreement is.
Okay, well, a prenuptial agreement is an agreement you enter into before you get married. That's the important point, before you get married. And what it allows you to do is basically write up a contract agreeing how you're going to divide in the event of a divorce in the future. Hopefully that won't happen. But if it does happen, it tells the court how you would like to divide up your assets and your liabilities, and also how other issues such as spousal support, whether you want to put restrictions on spousal support. Now, there's a couple of things you cannot do with a prenup. You can't include any provisions to do with custody. And the reason for that is because any custody decisions have to be related to the best interests of the child. And we don't know what that's going to be in the future. So we can't do that with custody. We also cannot restrict child support payments. But we can restrict spousal support, which is sometimes called either alimony or maintenance. So we can do that. And then there's other provisions, which are just simply against public policy. In other countries, for example, we have things called dowry, where one of the spouse's family gives money to the other spouse's family, or they provide that in the event of a divorce, they will give a sum of money. So that kind of provision where you're giving an incentive almost to get divorced, that would be against public policy. And then there's sort of more facetious type provisions. For example, I always give to my clients the example of a reciprocal agreement where the husband says, you know, in exchange for, you know, doing the dishes and loading the dishwasher correctly and putting my laundry in the basket each week, we'll have marital relations, you know, at least twice or three times a week. So that kind of thing obviously is against public policy. But the main purpose is to not create or put restrictions or modify the creation of community property during the marriage.
Okay, that's very interesting. Not to put restrictions on creating community property. So, Warren, everybody knows I'm not an attorney. I'm what is called a legal document preparation company, and I'm a mediator. So I inherit cases where I will mediate the separate property that people have going into the marriage, and then we take a look at how they want to handle creating community property once the marriage ensues. So could you just explore for a second the issue of community property and the extent to which it can be restricted in a prenuptial agreement?
So community property is created from the moment you get married to the date of separation. So there's a presumption, and that presumption is contained in Section 760 of the Family Code. And what that says is that any property acquired during the marriage is presumptively community property. And California is a community property state. Not all states in the union are community property states, but the community property states say that if you get divorced, then there is an obligation to divide the community property equally, 50-50. And so what you're doing with a prenup, you're making an exception. And so a fairly typical prenuptial agreement, for example, between professionals. Let's say you have two professional people. They come into the marriage with an equality of income and assets. So they're fairly equal. They have equal bargaining power. And so what you might find in that kind of situation is that they decide to keep everything separate. So they say, so everything they bring into the marriage remains separate. And then everything acquired during the marriage is also separate. So, for example, let's say the wife during the marriage starts a pension or invests in a 401k. In the prenup, we can say those assets will remain the wife's separate property. And it's the same with liabilities. So you can specify, and that's a fairly common type of prenup. And we actually call that a Dawley agreement, D-A-W-L-E-Y, after the first very important Supreme Court case in the 1970s that recognized the enforceability of prenuptial agreements.
So what if people lay out the tenets of what they do not want to have happen? We do not want to mix real estate. We don't want to mix bank accounts. We don't want to divide each other's pensions. And then the marriage is going along really well, and they go against the tenets of the prenup. How bad is that if they eventually get divorced?
So once you sign a prenup, you're kind of stuck with it, okay? Unless you voluntarily and both agree to modify the prenup during the marriage.
Oh, you can modify. Okay, this is good. This is good. Go ahead.
So it's really important when you do, that's why it's really important to have an experienced family lawyer who's done prenuptial agreements, who's very familiar with California family law, both the statutes and the cases, and not to have a document preparer or to go online and just get a cut and paste prenup. It's really important to have an experienced family lawyer, because what you're doing is you're drafting a contract. Now, in my office, I have some bookshelves, and on those bookshelves, one of the books I have is the Family Code. And that, just the code itself, is about, 4 or 5 inches thick. And then next to it, I have the California Practice Guide by Rutter. That is 3 volumes, and I would say that's about, 8 inches thick. And basically, what you're doing there is, with a prenup, you're rewriting the entire family code. So for most people, I think that a prenuptial agreement is going to be one of the most important documents that you will ever sign. But to go back to your question, the question about, what happens if you change your mind during the marriage? In that case, what you would then do is a postnuptial agreement. You would then change the terms of your prenup. Now, postnuptial agreement, we sometimes call that a transmutation agreement. And the big difference is that before you get married, you don't have any obligations or duties to the other partner. Whereas when you get married, all of a sudden you have what we call fiduciary duties. And those fiduciary duties are to deal fairly with your partner and not to take advantage of your partner financially. And so it's much trickier entering into a postnuptial agreement than entering into a prenuptial agreement.
Do you do many postnuptial agreements?
I don't do postnuptial agreements.
Oh, I wanted to ask this because I found this fascinating, Warren. I thought every attorney did prenuptial agreements, and I found that that is not a true statement. I actually tried referring a couple attorneys out some years ago until I found you, and realized by being told, no, we don't specialize in those, and they referred me to other attorneys that actually did. So there's got to be something tricky, serious, and a lot you need to know about prenuptial agreements to make them stand up in court.
Yeah, so I think that the reason quite a lot of family law attorneys don't do prenuptial agreements, and even fewer do postnuptial agreements, is a concern about malpractice. And what that means is that, let's say you do a prenuptial agreement where you agree to keep everything separate. And I've seen this happen quite a lot. This is often a situation where you have an extremely wealthy spouse who wants to keep all their income and assets, usually own a business, and they have several properties, and they're getting married to a younger person who may be in college or doesn't have that kind of wealth. And for whatever reason, they have this agreement that keeps everything separate and also puts restrictions or even tries to waive spousal support. And, you know, naively, the poorer spouse, or we refer to them as the out spouse often, maybe naively will enter into that agreement, not realizing the full consequences of doing that. Or maybe they have. Maybe they've been advised by their attorney what the consequences are, but they just go ahead and do it anyway. And, you know, 10 years down the road, 20 years down the road, even 30 years down the road, the wealthier spouse decides to trade in for a newer model. You know, and the poorer spouse, what are they going to do? They can't break the prenup because both parties were represented by good attorneys. Both parties complied with all the requirements of the Prenup Act. Both of them had full and accurate disclosure. The prenuptial agreement wasn't unconscionable when it was made in any sense. And so what is that out spouse going to do? Where is the out spouse going to look for income and assets? Well, maybe they will. Maybe they'll sue the attorney for malpractice. Maybe they'll say the attorney didn't advise them of all the consequences of signing this prenup. And you know, so it is a concern. But I think if you're an experienced attorney, you know what you're doing, and you comply with all the requirements of the Prenup Act, there's no reason why that prenup shouldn't be, you know, 99.9% enforceable. But here's the kicker. People are still going to sue. Even if it's 100% enforceable, people can still bring lawsuits. Doesn't mean they're going to succeed.
I find that fascinating. That is the best explanation of why every attorney doesn't do prenups. So let's talk about the enforceability of prenups. As many as I have inherited, Warren, when I go to file for what we call amicable divorces, when you and I were talking in our pre-interview time, you mentioned some aspects that absolutely need to be with a prenup that I have never seen with one client walking through this office. Can you please identify those aspects of a prenup that give it standing in court?
That's a very good question, Judith. So prenups And we're very lucky in California. I don't know if we're lucky, but we have a pretty well-defined body of law regarding prenuptial agreements. And the first place we look is the Uniform Premarital Act, which is in the Family Code. That's sections 1600 to 1617. And it tells us we need to do a few things. Number one, there has to be full and accurate disclosure of all income, assets, and liabilities.
What does that look like? Is there something tangible?
Yeah, I think a lot of attorneys use what we call a schedule of assets and debts. It's the same document that's published by the Judicial Council.
Disclosure forms that we use in divorce. Okay.
Exactly. So when you get divorced, you have to exchange disclosures, and you have to disclose all your income and all your assets and all your liabilities on these forms, and then you attach backup documentation. So, for example, with banks, you would attach a bank statement. With taxes, you would attach a tax statement, a tax return. And so you're on pretty safe ground if you follow that procedure. You do a schedule of assets and debts, and then you attach backup documentation, and then you exchange it with, you know, the other spouse. And the important thing is in the prenup itself, I believe, to have an index of all the documents that you've exchanged. I think that is quite important because, you know, who's going to remember what documents were exchanged in maybe 20, 25 years' time?
That's right.
And I think that the most prenups are, if they're going to be attacked at all or vulnerable, it's because they cannot prove that there was full and accurate disclosure prior to the prenup being entered into.
Excellent. What else?
The other thing is you need to have. Now, this is not an absolute requirement, but practically it is a requirement. Both parties must be represented by independent counsel. And there is a provision that says all you need is the opportunity to consult with independent counsel. But here's the problem. Let's say, you know, one of the parties has independent counsel and the other party doesn't have an attorney to review the document. Well, then the attorney preparing the document has to fully inform the other person of all the terms and legal effects of this agreement, premarital agreement, as well as the rights and obligations that they're relinquishing or giving up. Now, if you remember at the beginning of this, I said, like, I've got a family code, which is, you know, several inches thick, and then I've got an entire bookshelf of family. There's no way that you could summarize all the provisions in a prenuptial agreement and all the rights and obligations that you're either modifying or relinquishing in an opinion letter are not charged the client, you know, tens of thousands of dollars. It would be the longest opinion letter I've ever written. So for that reason, we always insist that both sides are represented by an attorney. That's very important.
Warren, have you ever handled a prenup when the other soon-to-be spouse did not want to hire an attorney? No, I trust everybody, everything's fine. Did you ever back out of representation out of concern that the other party wasn't acting responsibly for themselves, putting you in a difficult, maybe potential malpractice situation?
Well, I haven't. No, I have never backed out of that situation because you can. I've never been in that situation where I've had to back out, but I have been in a situation where I drafted the prenup and the attorney on the other side has refused to sign a certification in the prenup that they were representing the party. Now, usually in a prenup, you have a certification signed by both parties and their attorneys. And so if you ever go to court, it's fairly easy to prove that both parties are represented by the attorney, because you can see the attorney's John Hancock on the document. And I did have quite recently, it doesn't happen very often, I had an attorney out in Orange County. For whatever reason, thought the agreement was unfair and didn't like the agreement, and said she was not going to sign the agreement. And so we were presented with a dilemma. And so what we decided to do, and what the other side, the other party decided to do, which I think was a very wise decision, was at short notice to hire a new attorney. I feel that, you know, one of the things when negotiating a prenup is it's important that the attorneys do not substitute their judgment for that of the client. And what I mean by that, you know, prenups contain a lot of provisions and agreements which are very personal. They're very subjective. They reflect maybe the ethics and morality of and it's not my job as an attorney to tell someone, you know, how to live their life or, you know, what to do when they get married. My job is to inform them of all their rights and obligations during the marriage and how a prenuptial agreement might affect those rights and obligations. But at the end of the day, I'm not going to withhold my signature just because I don't like the prenup. It's not my job.
So the role of the attorneys in a duly represented prenuptial situation is not to negotiate with each other like what you do in divorce. It's more to inform, make sure the parties understand what they're asserting and putting forth in this agreement. Is that what you're saying, Warren?
Well, I even in a divorce, you know, the rules of ethics and the role of an attorney is always to try and negotiate and represent their client in accordance with the client's wishes. So the client always has an objective, whether it be a divorce or prenup. And so your job as an attorney is to try and effectuate that objective. Now, there's a lot of leeway given to an attorney in the types of tactics you can use or the types of strategies you employ. In divorce, you know, for example, in a divorce, you might decide on certain types of discovery, or you might decide on whether to issue subpoenas. But at the end of the day, both clients come to you and say, this is the agreement, the deal that we've struck. Now you put it into effect. Your job as an attorney, you can say, I think it's a bad deal. I don't agree with this. And you realize that, you know, but by agreeing to this provision, you're giving up any claim to spousal support. Do you realize you're giving up a claim to the pension or the family residence? You can tell them all these things, but at the end of the day, it's still the individual's right to make bad decisions.
Understood. And don't we all enjoy that right all too often?
So true. especially on day 123 of this pandemic.
Oh my gosh, you have been counting. Warren, in terms of counseling with clients during the organization of the prenup and documenting what they don't want to share, do you shed light on what they could and maybe would want to create as community property? So much of our time is spent, you know, documenting what they don't want to share, but don't people have to understand where they can be creating community property so that they're clear when they finish the prenup what they do and do not want for the future?
Exactly. And that's a good question. So, I mean, I just set out that kind of extreme prenup at one end of the spectrum, which was keeping everything separate. But more common is the type of prenup which where one spouse or both spouses want to keep all their pre-marriage property separate but agree that all their income and all their assets during the marriage should be community. And the reason for doing a prenup in that situation is because separate property has a nasty habit of becoming community if you're not careful. And I'll give you one example.
Yes.
Let's say you come into the marriage with a house that you owned prior to the marriage. You got a nice house in Beverly Hills, and there's a whole bunch of equity in it, and the title is, for hypothetically, in the husband's name. So it's his separate property title, his separate property. There's $1 million in equity when he gets married. He thinks, great, it's going to remain my property. I don't need to do a prenup. Here's the problem. If you don't have a prenup and there's a mortgage on the property, what's going to happen? Someone's going to be paying off the mortgage principal. Now, it doesn't matter if it's the wife or the husband paying it off. If you don't have a prenup, all that income is community. And guess what? The community's paying off the mortgage. So the community starts acquiring an interest. Okay, 5 years later, interests go down, and they decide to refinance. Again, there's no prenuptial agreement. And the husband thinks, well, that's fine. I'm gonna reduce my interest rate by a couple of points and save a lot of money. But guess what? By refinancing, the bank, it could be the same bank or a new bank, is paying off the old mortgage. And guess what? The credit, the reason you're getting the refi is based on community credit, presumptively. So the community is paying off the entirety of the principal. Guess what? Now you have a refi, and the community before that may have had, you know, 20% interest. Now it's suddenly gone up to 80%. So even though the husband, the title is in his name, he purchased the house before marriage, you get to a divorce and suddenly gets told by his attorney, wait a minute, there's a community interest of like 80% of the appreciation after the date of the marriage. And he says, I don't get it. I signed all the quick claim deeds. I did all the interspousal transfers. And that kind of situation is why divorce lawyers are in business. That's why we have a job.
And I just want to clarify for everybody listening, whenever Warren talks about the community, he's really talking about the husband and wife. And in a situation like he just described, husband owned the house prior to the marriage. Once all of these steps fall into place that he described, the wife, the other half of the community, has a vested interest now in the property, correct?
Exactly.
I just wanted to define the word community.
Okay. Exactly, Judith. I just want to make a little correction there because I've been using husband and wife, but it's really should be partners because same-sex couples can get married. And so it's really important for same-sex couples to realize that exactly the same, you know, rights and obligations apply to them as well.
Absolutely. Yeah, and even for me, I have to say, I have to be mindful of that extension of marriage in the way I use words and language. So I really appreciate that correction. I do. There are a couple more points of prenup standing in court, but I just wanted to take a break and say one little thing. I inherited a client, a couple that I was filing for divorce for, amicable divorce, and they had a very, very large prenup. He came from a family of real estate entrepreneurs, hugely successful. He was also very successful in creating financial instruments like annuities. He had the Midas touch on making money. She had a really beautiful condo in one of the wealthier areas on the west side of Los Angeles, maybe a little money in the bank, but that's pretty much it. And so they wanted to keep everything separate, and they really didn't define how they were going to create any community assets. But they forgot about the prenup. They had a good prenup. They forgot about it because he had such a natural appetite for making money. He just wanted to do it for her too. So they went against all the terms of the prenup, and it benefited her. Now that they're getting divorced, she was making more money because he commingled things and set up financial instruments for her, converting first the condo she came into the marriage with, then he made that multiply with other financial instruments. And it was interesting when we got to the settlement, because she really wasn't understanding that because they had violated the prenup, she came out ahead financially. And I literally had to turn them over to two attorneys. It was beyond anything I could describe to her after I gave her my very simplistic math. And that was the most unusual turn of events in a prenup I had ever seen. Where violating it became advantageous.
Well, I think, the term violating, it sounds to me is what may have happened, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that during the marriage, they were sort of vaguely aware of the prenup, but most prenups have a provision in that you can modify or you could do a transmutation. So it sounds like during the marriage, whether it was regard to, you know, investments or the condo or even the business, he decided to make modifications or transmutation or gift property to the wife. And so that's not that uncommon. But what I've seen recently is another situation which is really unfortunate, which is where one of the partners is in business and gets sued, and there's a big lawsuit and a big contingent, a liability, possible liability. And so that partner says to the other one, hey, I've got an idea. Why don't we transfer everything into your name? Why don't we transfer the family residence into your name? And if the creditor wins, we've saved all our property. And that happens, and they sign the quit claims and the transfers and the assignments. And then the lawsuit settles, and then the partner says, well, okay, we've settled the lawsuit, now let's transfer it back into joint names. And the other partner says, you know what? I think I'm going to get divorced now. It's a bit of a...
I love that.
Up yours, I think, is a way of saying that, yeah.
Yeah, I love that. And I have a case in mediation right now where it's very similar to that. I can't wait till we get to the mediation table. Okay, Warren, before we leave what gives standing to a prenup in court, I think there's a couple other points. You already said attorney representation on both sides is ideal. Full and accurate disclosure with support documents is required, a certification page. And then what about the timing of it and attorney signatures? I think that rounds it up, right?
Right. The timing is very important. You know, the worst call you can get is in my experience, I've been doing this for many years, but in my experience, nothing good ever comes from the phone call on Friday, late Friday afternoon, where someone's in a panic and they say, you know, I got to do this, and I have to do a prenup, and you say to them, when are you getting married? Or when would you like to get married? And they say, next week. So, you know, my advice is if you're going to do a prenup, practically think about it a couple of months before the wedding date. But in terms of the statute, in terms of the law, it says very clearly that the final draft of the prenup must be settled and agreed upon by all the parties and their attorneys, and then you have to wait 7 days before signing the agreement. Now, just to repeat that, it's 7 days between you agree upon the final draft and then you sign the document. It's got nothing to do with when you get married. You could sign the prenup on the day of the wedding, as long as there's that 7-day waiting period. And the idea for that is to allow both parties to cool off, reflect, and maybe change their minds. So again, what's important is the 7 days between the finalization of the prenup and the signing of the prenup. The okay. wedding date is not the relevant date.
All right. That's great to know. Now, what about attorney signatures? This is the last thing I have in my notes.
I think I sort of addressed that. It's really, I mean, is a certification on a prenup absolutely 100% required? No, it's not in the statute. The statute says you've got to either be represented by an attorney or you had the opportunity to consult with independent counsel. So this is nothing about actually the attorney signing the document, but I think it's good practice for attorneys to sign the document and certify that they were representing the parties.
All right. In the opposite, what if two people simply do their own agreement, finding something online, God forbid, and now they're in disagreement some years down the road? The fact that they did it themselves, does that disqualify the legitimacy in any way?
Well, that situation I would characterize as the Divorce Attorney Full Employment Act, because I'm sure if there's a lot of money involved, that's going to be litigated for several years. There is no reason why such a prenup would be invalid if both parties complied with all the requirements of the Premarital Act. But it's like asking someone, you know, if you're not a car mechanic, if you fix the engine, is it going to work? Or if you're not a doctor or a surgeon, can you do your own, you know, heart surgery? Practically, the answer is no. That's why we have attorneys.
That's a great example. All right. And you already kind of did address this. What if one spouse doesn't want to be represented by an attorney? Does that invalidate the prenup? And not really, right?
Not really, but it's going to almost certainly result in litigation down the road.
Okay. We did mention postnups. That comes up once in a while. So could you take us through a postnup? How does it become legitimate, and when does it go into effect?
Well, a postnuptial agreement, there's two types of postnuptial agreements. One, I think, is a more, not really a postnup per se. It's a marital settlement agreement. That is, the parties are separated, contemplating divorce, and they're entering into an MSA or marital settlement agreement, which is going to get incorporated into a divorce judgment. We don't like using the word divorce in California. We call it a dissolution. But I'm going to say divorce because that's what I, you know, grew up on. I think most people refer to it as divorce. But what I'm really talking about is the postnuptial agreement where, for whatever reason, the parties decide to change community property during the marriage. And it's different because when you're married, there are fiduciary duties towards each other. And the biggest one is not to take advantage. And if, let's say, for example, you have that, you have the house. I'll give you the example of the house. And it's in the title is in one partner's name. And during the marriage, for whatever reason, they decide to transfer it to the other partner or to transfer it to joint names. Presumptively, it's going to be invalid. Because it breaches fiduciary duties. Because usually, in most circumstances, there will be no consideration. There will be no equality of consideration in the transaction. Usually, one partner is getting something for nothing, and so presumptively, it's going to be invalid. The famous case on that is Burkle. B-U-R-K-L-E, and that was the guy that owned Ralph's. And I think they went back to court several times and went up to the Court of Appeal, and the Court of Appeal set the ground rules for postnuptial agreements. The other famous case, of course, is a couple of years back, was the McCourt case. with Jamie McCourt and Frank McCourt. Remember him? He owned the Dodgers.
Right.
And they did a post-nup. In fact, I think they did like three or four post-nups. And those guys were worth hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars. And they had some of the best, you know, biggest, smartest law firms in America drafting those documents. And still, the post-nup was invalidated after a trial. So even those guys didn't get it right. So it's terribly difficult to get a post-nup right. And most of the post-nups I've dealt with in, trials have been invalidated. Whereas most of the prenups are upheld.
Okay. Why do people do post-nups? Let me ask it a different way. Do the people who do post-nups do them because they didn't get around to a prenup, or they may want to change the prenup, or a little of each?
Well, that's a possibility, and that would be a situation where I think the chances of having an enforceable post-nuptial agreement would be much stronger. So, for example, let's say they didn't get around to it, but they were in the process of doing a prenup, and they just couldn't get it done in time. And then, you know, a couple of months after the wedding, they do the post-nup. Well, at that point, there really isn't going to be much community property created. So I think you've got a pretty good chance of that one being held up. But in my experience, most post-nups, with the exception of one situation, I think when people refi, it's fairly typical to do a post-nuptial agreement there, in addition to the usually a quick claim deed. And there's a lot of cases on refinancing. But my feeling is, and you know, this is anecdotal, and one of the reasons that I do not like doing them is often because it's really to defraud creditors. It's really, they're doing the post-nup because there's some potential liability and they just want to transfer assets to protect them. So, and there's a thing called the Unfair Fraudulent Transfer Act. So any transfers made with the intention of defrauding a creditor can be voided by the court, including, by the way, a marital settlement agreement or even a divorce judgment. So that's one of the reasons I don't like going near them.
All right, then can we leave the discussion with post-nups maybe at this point, in that if you're going to do a post-nup, maybe it should be done, a truly legitimate post-nup that you didn't get around to addressing everything, or you want to maybe revise something from a prenup, maybe do it within the first year, and that in and of itself will give it more standing?
Well, I'm not sure I want to elevate that into a rule, because I'm not familiar with any cases that do that. But I think it, you know, it would be a factor. I think it would be a factor.
Okay. And all right. So, Warren, what do you think the mindset of people who want prenups are? And with that, are people embarrassed that they don't want to share certain things with their soon-to-be spouse? What's that emotion like when you get people together?
Well, that's one of the hardest things about doing a prenuptial agreement, is that there are lots of emotions involved. And it does, I think, strike many people as sort of unromantic to be, you know, negotiating or haggling over finances when you're not even married. So I think that's one of the hardest things with a prenup. And it's a very good reason why in negotiating a prenup, it's good for the couple to sort of sit down beforehand and try and figure out what they want from a marriage, what their expectations are. That kind of reasoning and process, I think, is historically built into the prenuptial agreement. I mean, you know, I think, in the Catholic Church, you have to do, there's a process called the Canaan, I think it's the Canaan process, where you go to classes and they talk about marriage, they talk about finances. In the Jewish religion, you've got the ketubah, which goes back thousands of years and is sort of one of the earliest prenuptial agreements. So within, you know, even organized religion, the concept of a prenuptial agreement, which organizes the couple's finances, has a very long history. And I do talk to clients about that. I talked about the history of prenups.
When we were talking prior to this interview and you were talking about the ketubah, and that was the very first type of prenup, you also said something that I would like you to share with our listeners, and that is the evolution of marriage and what it means. Why people married years ago versus why they marry now. And well, love became part of it versus money.
Yeah, I think what I was talking about there was that, you know, we have an idea now that marriage is guided and the foundation of marriage is primarily romantic. But historically, I think that's a very modern thing. If you go back in history, marriage was very much an economic transaction. You know, if you like reading, you know, Jane Austen and Dickens and, you know, Victorian novels, you'll know that marrying into the right family, you know, if you were nobility, was very important. Marrying off your daughters to wealthy men was very important. If you were royalty, then it was even more important. Then you, in addition to being economic, it was also political. You know, the right marriages or the wrong marriages often resulted in war or peace. You go back even further to ketubah. And I did some research on that. And, you know, the Talmud, the reason the ketubah was obligatory, it said that the ketubah was instituted so that it will not be easy or cheap for a man to divorce the wife. And in the Talmud, the husband had to provide at least value of up to 200 zuz, which is about, a zuz is a quarter of a shekel. The idea was that the man, you know, if the woman was divorced, how is she going to support herself? So the original idea of the prenup or the ketubah was actually to provide for the wife. Whereas I think nowadays it's almost the complete opposite. You know, it's to keep, I'm all right, Jack, I'm going to keep all my property and the wife is not going to get any of it. So I think in some ways the rationale for prenup is actually, you know, turned 180 in the last couple of thousand years.
Warren, have you ever seen anybody break up over a prenup? I just thought about this, that it was so destructive that how can I be marrying you if you don't want to share any of this with me?
So the answer would be kind of. So I have in a couple of situations where the prenup got very heated. And again, it was a very wealthy property developer getting married to a sort of a younger woman who was going through college. Very smart woman. A couple of times when there was a walkout during the negotiations and she said, I'm not getting married to you. And that forced the guy to reconsider and to make some concessions and sort of be more reasonable. So in that situation, the marriage still went ahead. They as far as I'm aware, they're still happily married. And then the other situation is where you have a prenup that says the prenup is either going to maybe terminate after a certain number of years or another event's going to happen. I've not had it myself, but I've heard of stories where that provision in a prenup forces one of the spouses to file for divorce.
Yes.
I mean, but the same thing happens in marriage anyway. I mean, you know, in California, if the rules, the law on spousal support is that if the length of the marriage is less than 10 years, presumptively, the length of time for spousal support is half the length of the marriage. But once you hit that 10-year mark, if it's any longer than 10 years, support is payable, presumptively, until the death of either party or the remarriage of the recipient of support. So I certainly think there's a lot of people who, you know, file because they meet that 10-year mark.
The toughest of all to mediate when they're right at that 10-year mark or between 10 and 11 years. I think they're the toughest of all. Warren, before we leave our audience, is there anything you would like to add that I haven't asked?
First of all, I just want to mention my website, if that's okay.
Yes, I'm definitely going to ask, please, how can people get in touch with you?
www.californiaprenuptial.com. And I'll give you my office number. Can I give my office number out as well?
Absolutely, anything you want.
It's 310-247-9913. That's 310-247-9913. I want to just say, I don't think prenups are for everyone. I think it's a choice. I think the most important guiding principle, if you're going to do a prenup, is to be like reasonable, to be fair and equitable in your dealings with each other, because, you know, frankly, that's what you should be anyway. That's how we should treat each other. And, you know, a marriage is a union. It's it is a community, and you should respect and share not only your affections, but also your income and property. So that's a guiding principle. Now, if you ask me what fair and reasonable and equitable is, I mean, you know, how long is a piece of string? That's the $64,000 question.
I know. Well, Warren, this has been delightful. I've so appreciated you sharing your knowledge on prenuptial agreements and postnups, and I can't wait for the rest of the series. So thank you again for coming on the show. And I thank all of you for listening every single week to Constructive Uncoupling, the podcast devoted to amicable divorces. Please share this with your friends. You can subscribe, and every Wednesday, our episode will be uploaded to any of your devices. And of course, if any of you would like to propose a topic for me, you can reach me at my email address, Judy, J-U-D-Y, at constructiveuncoupling.com, Judy at constructiveuncoupling.com. Thank you so much for listening, and I will talk to you next week.